Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. The remaining pages of this book are starting to look very narrow, at least in comparison with the pages we've already been through. Today's chapter is Book 14, Chapter 2. One of the most obvious and advantageous departures from the so-called laws of war is the action of scattered groups against men pressed together in a mass. Such action always occurs in wars that take on a national character. In such actions, instead of two crowds opposing each other, the men disperse, attack singly, run away when attacked by stronger forces, but again attack when opportunity offers. This was done by the guerrillas in Spain, by the mountain tribes in the Caucasus, and by the Russians in 1812. People have called this kind of war guerrilla warfare, and assume that by so calling it, they have explained its meaning. But such a war does not fit in under any rule, and is directly opposed to a well-known rule of tactics which is acceptable as infallible. That rule says that an attacker should concentrate his forces in order to be stronger than his opponent at the moment of the conflict. Guerrilla war, always successful as history shows, directly infringes that rule. This contradiction arises from the fact that military science assumes the strength of an army to be identical with its numbers. Military science says that the more troops, the greater the strength. Les gros battalions ont toujours raison, or large battalions are always in the right. For military science to say this is like defining momentum in mechanics by reference to the mass only, stating that momenta are equal or unequal to each other simply because the masses involved are equal or unequal. Momentum, a quantity of motion, is the product of mass and velocity. In military affairs, the strength of an army is the product of its mass and some unknown X. Military science, seeing in history innumerable instances of the fact that the size of any army does not coincide with its strength, and that small detachments defeat larger ones, obscurely admits the existence of this unknown factor and tries to discover it. Now in a geometric formation, now in the equipment employed, now and most usually in the genius of the commanders. But the assignment of these various meanings to the factor does not yield results which accord with the historic facts. Yet it is only necessary to abandon the false view, adopted to gratify the heroes, of the efficacy of the directions issued in wartime by commanders, in order to find this unknown quantity. That unknown quantity is the spirit of the army, that is to say, the greater or lesser readiness to fight and face danger felt by all the men composing an army, quite independently of whether they are or are not fighting under the command of a genius. In two or three line formations, with cudgels or with rifles that repeat 30 times a minute, men who want to fight will always put themselves in the most advantageous conditions for fighting. The spirit of an army is the factor which, multiplied by the mass, gives the resulting force. To define and express the significance of this unknown factor, the spirit of an army, is a problem with science. This problem is only solvable if we cease arbitrarily to substitute for the unknown X itself the conditions under which that force becomes apparent, such as the commands of the general, the equipment employed, and so on. Mistaking these for the real significance of the factor, and if we recognize this unknown quantity in its entirety as being the greater or lesser desire to fight and to face danger. Only then, expressing known historic facts by the equations and comparing the relative significance of this factor, can we hope to define the unknown. 10 men, battalions, or divisions fighting 15 men, battalions, or divisions conquer, that is, kill or captive, or take captive, all the others, while themselves losing 4, so that on the one side 4 and on the other 15 were lost. Consequently, the 4 were equal to the 15, and therefore 4x equals 15y. Consequently, x divided by y equals 15 divided by 4. This equation does not give us the value of the unknown factor, but gives us a ratio between two unknowns. And by bringing variously selected historic units, battles, campaigns, periods of war, into such equations, a series of numbers could be obtained in which certain laws should exist and might be discovered. The tactical rule that an army should act in masses when attacking and in smaller groups in retreat unconsciously confirms the truth that the strength of an army depends on its spirit. To lead men forward under fire, more discipline, obtainable only by movement in masses, is needed than is needed to resist attacks. But this rule, which leaves out of account the spirit of the army, continually proves incorrect, and is in particularly striking contrast to the facts when some strong rise or fall in the spirit of the troops occurs, as in all national wars. The French retreating in 1812, though according to tactics they should have separated into detachments to defend themselves, congregated into a mass because the spirit of the army had so fallen that only the mass held the army together. The Russians, on the contrary, ought, according to tactics, to have attacked in mass, but in fact they split up into small units because their spirit had so risen that separate individuals, without orders, dealt blows at the French without needing any compulsion to induce them to expose themselves to hardships and danger. All right, there we go, another chapter down, and the French army are in a shambles. There's some interesting science behind the chemicals being released in a person's brain as they're winning a fight, as opposed to as they're losing a fight. And I suppose, you know, if you look at that in like a boxing match, as they lose, they're more likely to keep losing. It's all a mind game. But I'm sure a pro boxer has the mental capacity, the mental training, I suppose is actually the better word, to overcome that and still feel like a winner, even if they've just taken 5 hard punches to the face in a row. But perhaps these soldiers, after being kicked to the ground, don't have that that will to keep their spirits up. And I think that would compound when you're surrounded by others, because it's not just one person, it's their whole army, all their troops. So whichever way the mood sways, if everyone starts to feel disheartened, they all notice each other being disheartened, and it compounds. And they've weakened themselves. They're opening themselves up to make mistakes. They're scurrying away, trying to get out of Russia. And the Russians, on the complete flip side, they're all pumped up. They've got a win. The wind is back in their sails, you know, and they're looking for an opportunity to harass and kick and push and shove the French out of their country. As the French are getting weaker, they're compounding and compacting into a smaller and smaller mass, or smaller and smaller volume, I should say. Is that the word? Oh God, I'm getting it all mixed up. They're scrunching together. That's what they're doing. Let's use layman's terms. But the Russians are doing the opposite. They're sort of dispersing out. They're going off in little packs rather than one big pack. And a little pack is actually quite effective. It's funny, I always imagined, when you think of guerrilla warfare, I imagined sort of the losing team or the weaker team being the ones to employ those guerrilla tactics. But in this case, that's not what's happening. It's the Russians who are detaching and forming little troops and just sort of harassing and being a pain, being a pest to the French. And by this point, there's really nothing for it, is there? The French have lost, the Russians have won. The French are just trying to do damage control, I suppose, at this point, lose as few troops as possible and get the hell out of there. Sardonicus 09 said, "Spirit definitely seems to matter, but it doesn't always bring victory. Other factors that seem to matter are superior communications, better military intelligence, better logistics, advanced technology. There are probably others. One potential factor that Tolstoy isn't shy about discrediting: superior generalship. Sardonicus is also linked to an interesting Wikipedia article, which is the list of last stands. And I suppose any last stand has a very spirited army defending the last of their army. The definition is: a last stand is a military situation where a normally small defensive force holds a position against a significantly more powerful attacking force, often not necessarily though as their final act before being defeated. And then it has a big long list of all these last stands, and you can see that in some of them the defenders, the smaller, are actually victorious. They win the last stand, but in many cases they've lost that last stand, despite how spirited they may have been. Alright, that's going to do us for today's episode. Thank you very much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow. Whoa, wait a second. Before I go, I've missed this twice in a row, so third time's a charm. We've just hit another milestone. This is the 300th episode. Congratulations to everyone for getting through 300 chapters of War and Peace. Very nicely done, and thank you for sticking around for 300 episodes. We've only got 60 or so to go, so things are looking pretty exciting. I missed the 100 episode anniversary, I'm pretty sure, although that was 200 days ago now, so I can't quite remember. And I'm pretty sure I missed the 200 day anniversary as well. Did I? Maybe I'm just really forgetful. But anyway, 300. Nicely done. Congratulations. See you tomorrow.